I think there's visibility at this point that I can see and be seen, and I prefer standing up. I'm going to make a comparison between reform movements in the 16th century, the period of Luther, for as a matter of fact, there was not one Reformation, but at least four, two Catholic and two Protestant on the Catholic side, a liberal reform movement led by Erasmus of Rotterdam, and I shall center our consideration on him, and on the other hand, a rigoristic, highly disciplined and dogmatic reform, which issued in the Council of Trent and determined the subsequent history of Catholicism, really down to Pope John. And on the Protestant side, the main Reformation of men like Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, Cranmer, and so on, and alongside of that, a radical Reformation of Anabaptist spiritual reformers. And the curious thing is that the lines cut across, and that the liberal Catholic reform contributed many of the ideas and concepts to the more radical type of Protestant reform. What I am saying may be repetition to some of you, because last Saturday, inasmuch as certain people were leaving, I was asked to give a little survey of what I'm going to cover now in four evenings. I'll have to crave your indulgence for a measure of repetition, but it won't be all repetition, for I shall introduce a good deal of new material. A thought which occurs to one at once is, why there should be any need for a reformation? Why does a religious movement run downhill? It's partly, of course, due to the fact that enthusiasm always cools off, and that often the second and the third generations do not have the zeal of the first. But there are other reasons, I think, and some of them may be classified under the failures of success. When Christianity expands and takes in new cultures, they bring with them the whole set of ideas and practices which they had previously. Christianity, in order to reach them, has to use their vocabulary and accommodate itself somewhat to their modes of behavior. Then they come in with all of that background. They rethink Christianity in their own terms. In the process, Christianity may be enriched, and at the same time, it may be corrupted. So that a great deal of paganism survived in Christianity all through the Middle Ages and into the age of the Reformation. There are other failures of success. The church in the Middle Ages became enormously wealthy precisely because it was so magnificent in its philanthropy. Thereupon, vast tracts of land were given to the church, and wealth is corrupting. It can lead to indolence and luxury and lack of zeal, loss of zeal. And then there was power. The church did not seize power for the sake of power, but stepped into a power vacuum. When the order of the Roman Empire broke down and the barbarians invaded, the bishops of Rome in Italy had resources vastly in excess of those of the government, and when there were prisoners to be ransomed and refugees to be cared for, the church stepped in and did all that which previously had been done by the state. But having in this manner acquired political power, it became enamored of power and involved in the struggles of power. And then, too, some reforms become needful because earlier reforms fail to achieve their objectives. For example, in the Middle Ages, there was a great attempt to stop warfare between all of the new kingdoms which had arisen. But the only way in which that warfare was reduced was by turning from a war at home to a war abroad. The peace campaign ended in the Crusades against the infidels. Then again, there was another reform. The bishops were married in the early Middle Ages. Often their sons succeeded. Bishoprics became a matter of family dynasties. And partly to break that up, the church insisted on clerical celibacy. But actually, clerical celibacy led to clerical concubinage. The priests did not give up their wives, but they no longer ranked as wives. And by the time of the Reformation, concubinage was widespread, and the church actually collected taxes on concubines and bastards. Then the church attempted in the High Middle Ages to be an international organization and in the name of justice to regulate the affairs of various peoples. And in the 13th century, the church actually wielded greater power than any civil power. But the church exercised that power by playing one off against another, became so embroiled in the whole political process that by the time of the Renaissance and the Reformation, the church had become largely itself a secularized Italian city-state. This then was the situation in the early 16th century, and all high-minded men recognized that something was wrong, drastically wrong, and reform highly needful. One preacher said to a congregation, "You needn't think that John the Baptist and the Virgin Mary will intercede for you. They're fed up." Such then was the attitude, and there were many attempts at reform, and one of them was the liberal Catholic reform of the early 16th century. It was liberal and it was possible, in part because the church felt comparatively secure and was willing to admit of a measure of public criticism. Comparatively secure because the sectarian movements of the late Middle Ages had been suppressed. One mustn't think of the Protestant Reformation as the first movement of revolt. From the 12th century on, southern France and northern Italy had simply swarmed with sects. The Valdensi, the Paterini, the Paperbrusiani, Carthusiani, Umiliati, the Hussites, the Wycliffites, and so on and so on. One would be surprised at how many of these movements there were. But one by one, the Inquisition had picked them off. The Jews had been expelled from Spain. Spain had been consolidated as a Christian nation. The Moors had been conquered. The Hussites in Bohemia had been contained. The church felt that she had crushed all of the revolting movements. There was a period of latitude and of freedom for criticism. In those first years, first two decades of the century, of Luther's century, there were then movements of reform, and there was one which was popularly called evangelism in the sense of the evangel, the gospel, going back to simple New Testament Christianity, sweeping away the corruptions and simplifying the structure of the church. This movement had its adherents in all countries, in England with people like Colet and More, in France with Lefebvre, in Spain with Cardinal Ximenes, in Italy with quite a number of cardinals, Ghiberti, Contarini, Pole, Sadoletto, Serepando, and others. I know I'm just reeling off names, but I want to impress you with the fact that this was a European movement. But its most outstanding representative was Erasmus of Rotterdam. So I am going to give you now a sketch of his life down to the period of the emergence of Luther. And tomorrow night, I'll give an account of Luther down through the Diet of Worms. And on the third, continue Luther through the Diet of Augsburg, and for that matter to his death, and then come back again to Erasmus and the clash between the liberal Catholic and the Protestant Reformations. For it is an interesting and rather a sad fact that the most acute conflict of Protestantism with Catholicism was with the best elements in Catholicism. Often reforms become as hostile to each other as they are to that which they're trying to correct. Both of them are passionately concerned to get things right, but they differ as to their programs and then begin to clash with each other. Well, now I'll come back again to Erasmus. And he was filled with a magnificent dream, with a hope that later seemed fantastic, that the church could be reformed and civil society also could be rejuvenated. And this was to be achieved by turning to the past. The revolutionary movements of our day are frequently contemptuous of the past. All of that is a mistake. We must push on to something new. In the 16th century, there was a rebellion against the immediate past, but by a return to a more remote past, which meant, in the case of the church, to go back to Jesus, the Gospels, the New Testament, which meant in civil society to go back to the wisdom of the ancients, of Plato, of Aristotle, of Cicero, of Plutarch. Erasmus hoped to revive society and the church by recovering the glory that was Greece, the splendor that was Rome, and the grace that was of Galilee. This, he believed, could be accomplished by education. He had Jefferson's confidence in education. In fact, Jefferson is a good deal of an Erasmian spirit. If only men could be instructed, they would be wise. Erasmus did not plan to be a teacher. He was a teacher of teachers. He would provide the materials for education. This meant that he would make available all of the great works of classical and Christian antiquity. He would edit the writings of people like Plutarch and Seneca, and on the other hand, of the early church fathers like Irenaeus and Hilary and Jerome and Augustine, but above all else, the Bible, the New Testament. He was, throughout his life, basically an editor. And no man worked more furiously to take advantage of the new technology of his age than Erasmus. And the great invention was the printing press. He went up and down Europe, always seeking manuscripts, scholars, and publishers. He was criticized for going around so much, but he said, "How could the Apostle Paul have converted Europe if he stayed in Tarsus? If Ulysses was the wisest man in Greece because he visited so many cities, my horse is the wisest in Europe because he has attended so many universities." By the way, he always used a horse. They didn't use the rivers very much because they didn't have a Hertz rent a horse system. And when they got downstream, they had to have the horse. So, of course, you could take a horse down on the barge, but not as many horses as you could passengers. So normally they traveled on horseback. And we find Erasmus in the Low Countries, in Brussels, in Antwerp, in Deventer. We find him in Paris and Orléans, Oxford, Cambridge, London, Venice, Freiburg, Basel, Rome. Traveling, and staying for a year or two in a place, bringing out books with one publisher and then with another. He was then to be one of the great educators of his generation. We don't know exactly when he was born. His own statements vary. Some of them point to 1466 and some to 1469. The matter is of extreme importance for determining when to have the commemoration. The Swiss have had theirs in 66 and the Dutch are going to have theirs in 69. And like a good Erasmian, I'm going to bring my book out in between in 68. But anyhow, he was Dutch. He was Erasmus of Rotterdam. And he was the illegitimate son of a priest. The father was not irresponsible. He provided money for Erasmus and an older brother. The mother had to take charge of their early training and sent them to Deventer. Now, Deventer in Holland was the center of the Brethren of the common life. The Brethren were a new quasi-monastic order founded sometime earlier. They lived in community. They were engaged in religious exercises and education and often placed their members in schools throughout the land. They took no permanent vows. They were free to come and to go. However, under pressure from the other orders, one group of the Brethren finally succumbed to and joined the Augustinian canons and did take permanent vows. The outstanding leader of the Brethren of the Common Life, best known to us at any rate, is Thomas a Kempis, and his best known work, The Imitation of Christ. There are three notes which run through that work, and they recur constantly later in the writings of Erasmus, One is a lyrical piety toward Jesus. Another is the imitation of Christ, the following in his steps, particularly the way of suffering. And the third is an aversion to overly refined theological speculation. Thomas A. Kempis says, the Trinity is better pleased by adoration than by speculation. And another member of the order said, how much theology did the penitent thief have? Christ said to him, this day thou shalt be with me in paradise. He hadn't been baptized, he hadn't been catechized, he hadn't been confirmed, he hadn't been to the Lord's Supper, he didn't know anything about transubstantiation, he didn't know anything about the consubstantiality of the Son and the Father, he didn't know any of that, and yet Christ said, this day thou shalt be with me in paradise. How little theology it takes to be saved. Such was the conclusion of this member of the Brethren of the Common Life. Now, Erasmus had his training in the school of the Brethren. They were not averse to the culture of the Renaissance with its revival of the classical literature, because they held that there was very much in the pagan writers, particularly on morals, which was compatible with and filled out certain gaps in Christian teaching, because, for example, the New Testament has very little to say about political morality. This they could draw from the writings of the ancients. The Brethren then were not averse to this. That is, some of them were not. And Erasmus, as a boy, in his early years, conceived a great enthusiasm both for the Church Fathers and the Bible, and also for the classical authors. His father and mother died of the plague when he was about 12. When he was 16, the question was, what next? The guardian, who had been in charge of his funds, had to report that they had been dissipated somehow, and he thought the only thing to do with a boy with literary interests was to make him a monk. Erasmus and his brother wanted to go to the university, but they had nothing. Well, they might beg their way through. But great pressure was brought to bear upon them to become monks. There were two branches, as I said, of the order, one with permanent vows and one without. In after years, Erasmus greatly regretted that he had not joined the branch which did not have permanent vows. Well, why didn't he? Because he had lived in the house of that branch for 2 years, and in that particular house, he found none of the brothers who shared his enthusiasms. But the monastery which took the vows had a magnificent library. That was something Erasmus could not resist. Luther went into the monastery to save his soul, and Erasmus to get a fine collection of books. He was 16 years old. He was in the monastery for 6 years. During that time, he had spiritual upheavals. It's often been said that he never had any Damascus Road experience. Well, he didn't have anything as acute as Luther's, but he did have his ups and his downs. Periods of frightful depression, centering on the fear of death. Not as with Luther, the fear of the judgment after death, but the fear that he would die before he was ready for fellowship with God. The whole of life he regarded as a preparation for death. Would he be ready? Would he be capable of the vision of God? He said, I have seen monks dissolved in tears in the contemplation of God, but it has never come to me. He sought spiritual consolation. A confessor, Luther had his Staupitz. Erasmus also found a confessor, but a woman and not a priest. A widow who used her wealth to found monasteries. Two of her daughters were nuns. She herself kept open house for priests and monks who came in for mutual consultation and guidance. And she it was who became a spiritual counselor to Erasmus and saved him from those early depressions. but I mustn't go into too great detail about his monastic life. Suffice it to say that he was not wholly satisfied. He had tilts with some of the monks who did not appreciate his classical studies, nor was he wholly rebellious. In later years, the brothers looked upon him as the luminary of their order, and whenever he was in their area, he always went to see them. So it's false to represent him, as some have done, as bitterly hostile to monasticism from beginning to end, or, on the other hand, to say that he was entirely content and that his criticisms developed only later. It was neither exactly one nor the other. At the end of 6 years, the prior saw that he was getting restive. Perhaps he'd read all the books in the library by that time. And the prior thought that he would fare better if he were secretary to a bishop and secured him such a post. But the bishop really had no need for him, and he was generous. He gave him a small stipend, which enabled him, after all, to go to the University of Paris. Here he was a candidate for the degree of doctor in theology. He was thoroughly alienated by the problems which were being discussed by the theological faculty in Paris. He said that the professors reminded him of a character in Greek legend, Epimenides by name, who went to sleep for 47 years, except that he did wake up. Here was the kind of a question which they discussed. If God had so chosen, could he have become incarnate, not in the man Christ Jesus, but in a donkey or a pumpkin? Oh, nonsense, Erasmus would say. Why waste your time over such a silly question? But as a matter of fact, there was an assumption lying behind it which was not so silly. And Erasmus, I think, really sensed that and rejected the assumption. The point was this. If God is omnipotent, if he can do absolutely anything, can he make black white? Can he make wrong right? Can he make dark light? Can he cause the past not to have been the past so that a harlot would be a virgin? Can he do something ridiculous, preposterous, such as becoming incarnate in a donkey or a pumpkin? It was a question with regard to the absoluteness of power in God. Is there any limitation to omnipotence? Erasmus felt, though he didn't use these words, that not only does power corrupt, but absolute power corrupts even God. God cannot be moral unless there are some limitations self-imposed in his very character. He cannot be consistent if there's no law of consistency. Erasmus would not grant that God can do absolutely anything. God must be good, and that involves a limitation. Now this comes up again in his controversy with Luther with regard to the absoluteness of God's power. Erasmus studied theology for 6 years in Paris. At the end of that time, he had not yet taken his degree, and the bishop thought he was becoming a professional graduate student. He cut him off. Under those circumstances, he did what graduate students often do. He earned money by tutoring. And this was the best thing that ever happened to him, because it led him to commence the preparation of those educational manuals, which in more developed form and published later on, were to be used in the schools all over Europe and in the American colonies well into the 18th century. He truly became the teacher of Europe. In part, these tools at first were designed simply to teach boys Latin. One must remember that this was the spoken language of all educated people in Europe. There are 11 volumes of the letters of Erasmus and some 600 correspondents, and everyone is writing to him in Latin and he replying in Latin. It was a spoken language. The boys had to use Latin on the playground. And if they did not, one of their members was chosen each week to spy on them, and he was punished if he didn't report. He had to report anyone who was caught speaking German in Luther's case, or French or Dutch on the playing ground. Therefore, one of Erasmus' early works was a little manual on how to play games in Latin. He began with these little exercises. And then he wrote a little manual on manners for boys. Here's an excerpt. A dripping nose is filthy. To wipe it on cap or sleeve betokens a peasant. To rub it off on the arm or elbow is the mark of a vendor of salt herring. Erasmus hated salt herring. It's not much better to wipe with the hand and then rub on the clothes. Better to use a handkerchief and turn away the head. If you blow through thumb and finger to the ground, bury the mucus quickly with your foot. If you have to yawn, cover your mouth with a handkerchief or your palm and make the sign of the cross. To laugh at everything is silly. To laugh at nothing is stupid. To laugh at bawdy jokes is dirty. A guffaw which rocks the whole body is not becoming at any age, and certainly not for children. A laugh should not sound like the whinny of a horse, nor in laughing should one show the teeth like a dog. The expression of the face can show hilarity. We have a manual on manners written by Clement of Alexandria in the 2nd century. And it's not a repetition, but manners apparently had not greatly improved in the intervening period. But he begins writing these little books. He also began a work which was to enjoy an enormous popularity, namely a collection of proverbs from classical antiquity. One wonders why it was that in this period proverbs had so great a popularity, for Erasmus started off, but others began to publish them also. Men perhaps were turning from the art of dying to the art of living. The most popular book in the late Middle Ages was the Ars Moriendi, the art of dying. And now the adagia, adages, epigrams. What is the secret of the popularity of the proverb? I think this, that it represents universal folk wisdom. And the belief was that that which is accepted by all men has a claim to truth. It was Abraham Lincoln's principle. You can't fool all of the people all of the time. Now, the proverb is the quintessence of popular wisdom. Someone has reproached Erasmus because he collected proverbs but didn't create them. But literary men don't create proverbs. The proverb, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, was not created by a poet. I suspect it was created by a stable boy. But just as musicians take folk music and make out of it symphonies, so literary men can take proverbs and make out of them essays. And that is what Erasmus did. He collected something over 800 proverbs for his first edition. He ended up with about 5,000. And around many of them, he built essays. For example, war is sweet to him who has not tasted it. And that grew into an essay. Dulce bellum inexpertis. Sweet is war to those not experienced. Here are a few of the proverbs which have come down into all of our languages. To carry off the palm, as many men as many minds, to champ at the bit, to leave no stone unturned, where there's smoke, there's fire, a necessary evil, know yourself, the mountain labors and brings forth a mouse, a rare bird, with one foot in the grave, many hands make light work, swallow your own spittle, to mix fire and water, to fight with one's own shadow. This folk wisdom, he begins collecting as a guide to living. Now, these little manuals he started to write in rough form for the boys whom he was tutoring. But another advantage came out of all this, namely that he made friends with students. and those students were greatly to influence his later career. The first ones were North Germans from Lübeck, and the next were English, and among them was Lord Mountjoy, a nobleman of substance, who invited Erasmus to go to England. He crossed the Channel in the year 1500, and went at first to stay in Lord Mountjoy's country estate. We have the letter which he wrote back, the first letter he wrote back to France. It was addressed to a man named Faustus Andrelinus, whom we shall meet again. He was an Italian, living in Paris, had become an enthusiastic lover of France and had taken on French citizenship. He was the poet laureate of France, and very distinctly a gay blade. Erasmus wrote to him, "You would scarcely know your Erasmus. I have become a hunter and a courtier, and if you knew the sweetness of the kisses of these English nymphs, you would fly over the Channel like Daedalus, even if you had the gout." Now, some have supposed that Erasmus was not conducting himself in a manner suitable to that of a young monk or a young priest. There are two things to remember. One is that kissing on meeting between the sexes was an English but not a continental custom in that period. The other, that Erasmus had a remarkable capacity for accommodating himself to the tastes of his correspondent. Often his letters are more revealing about the person to whom he is writing than about himself. And Faustus Andrelinus was a gay blade. We'll meet him again. But Erasmus certainly did not stay long at the country estate of Lord Mountjoy. We find him very speedily at Oxford, working very diligently on his studies and staying with the Augustinian canons. That was the branch of the Brethren of the Common Life which he had joined, and we can see that there was no rift with the order. He was working very diligently at Oxford, and there he came in contact with a remarkable group of young men. Among them, Thomas More, later Sir Thomas More and Saint Thomas More. Another was Colet, who became the Dean of St. Paul's, and there were half a dozen more. I won't go into too great detail. Some have thought that they changed the whole course of Erasmus' career and turned him from classical to Christian studies. I don't think that's true, because he was interested in the Christian as well as the classical before, and in the classical as well as the Christian afterwards. That isn't the change. But they did influence him profoundly, partly on the personal side, for here were young men of substance, who came from the higher classes of society, men who were highly gifted, destined to the highest posts in church and state, intellectually brilliant, who treated with respect and deference this illegitimate son of a priest, with admiration for his gifts and respect for his character. And above all, he was impressed by the quality of these men, who, having everything external which their age could offer, were of the type willing to throw it all away for the sake of their convictions, as they later proved. And their mettle was already apparent. There is, on the one hand, a greater self-confidence in Erasmus after this encounter, and also a greater dedication. They also affected him with regard to the progress of his further studies and of his concepts, and first of all, because they persuaded him that he must learn Greek if he were to revive the glories of antiquity. He could not be content with Latin, because the Romans had borrowed very largely from the Greeks. He would have to be able to read Plato and Aristotle and Plutarch and all of the rest in the original. So for the next few years of his life, he was very diligently devoted to the mastery of Greek. The other point was in the realm of ideas. They acquainted him with the revival of Neoplatonism, which had taken place in Italy, in Florence, in what was called the Neo. Most of these young men had been in Italy. Thomas More had not, but he had learned Italian, and he had translated the works of some of these Italian philosophers. Neoplatonism is a variety of Platonism. Erasmus certainly did not borrow all of its concepts, but he was affected by one concept, which actually goes back to Plato himself, and that is the dualism between flesh and spirit. Now, one has that dualism in the Apostle Paul, who talks about the flesh and the spirit. But Paul, when he talks about flesh, does not mean the physical, corporeal aspect of man, but anything that wars with the spirit. Envy, pride, these are flesh for Paul, and they're not physical. But with the Neoplatonists, it's the physical component of man, which is a tomb or a prison of his spirit. He cannot be emancipated from it in this life, and the body is not wholly evil. Still, it is something of an impediment. The passions are attached to the body. And the religious life consists in emancipating oneself from all of the impediments of the flesh, from all of the hindrances of the senses, until rising above time and space and all that is of the exterior physical world, one is wrapped in contemplation and union with the ineffable one. This is Neoplatonic mysticism. Now, if you combine that with Christianity, and it had been done before, the tendency will be to disparage all of the external physical aids to religion. Carried to the extreme, it may mean the giving up of art, because that is physical, visual, appeals to the eye. It may lead to the giving up of music, that is sensory, it comes through the ear. It may very well lead to the giving up of all food and fast regulations, those have to do with eating something physical. It may spiritualize the sacrament, saying that there is no physical presence of Christ upon the altar, or perhaps give up the sacraments altogether. Now, Erasmus was never willing to go so far. He said he would not wrench all of these aids from the common people, but he did feel that there should be an emancipation from the things of sense and the centering always on the spirit. But some of his followers, Zwingli, the Anabaptists, the English Puritans, did reject images, music, feasts and fasts, liturgical vestments, even the sacraments, as with the Quakers. So that actually the line of influence of Erasmus in one respect goes into the more radical type of Protestantism. Erasmus would never leave the Church of Rome, and yet in some respects he was subversive of the Church of Rome. And Melanchthon said if Luther had not arisen to arrest the radicalness of Erasmus in this regard, the results would have been much more subversive. So here is the strange complication of these reformatory movements. Erasmus, after about 5 months in England, went back to the continent, and there he wrote a little book called The Dagger of the Christian Soldier. He was requested to do it by a woman who was married to a husband, Johann von Papenreuther, but his name doesn't matter, except that it's interesting to pronounce. Johann von Papenreuther was a manufacturer of armaments in the Netherlands, which he sold either to the French or to the emperor, depending on who would pay the most. He was a loose fellow, and the wife was hopeful that Erasmus might be able to convert him. So for him, Erasmus wrote The Dagger of the Christian Soldier. When it was done, Erasmus says, I presented it to him, and he reciprocated by giving me his dagger, but neither made any use of the weapon of the other. But the dagger of the Christian soldier had an enormous use. Before the end of the century, it had gone into 8 of the vernaculars of Europe, including Spanish and Polish. I'll give you just an excerpt. Do you think you will move God by the blood of a bull or by incense? The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. You venerate the wood of the cross and have no regard for the mystery of the cross. You fast, refraining from that which does not defile, but you do not refrain from obscene conversation. You adorn a temple of stone, but of what use is this, if the temple of the heart is full of abominations? With the mouth you bless, with the heart you curse. You enclose your body in a cell, while your mind wanders over the earth. Creep not upon the earth, my brother, like an animal. Put on those wings which Plato says are caused to grow on the soul by the ardor of love. Rise above the body to the spirit, from the visible to the invisible, from the letter to the mystical meaning, from the sensible to the intelligible, from the involved to the simple. Rise as by rungs until you scale the ladder of Jacob. As you draw nigh to the Lord, he will draw nigh unto you. If with all your might you strive to rise above the cloud and the clamor of the senses, he will descend from light inaccessible, and that silence which passes understanding, in which not only the tumult of the senses is still, but the images of all intelligible things keep silence. There's a Christianizing of Neoplatonic mysticism, rising above all the things of sense, to that place where all intelligible things keep silence. Now, all of that can fit in with the piety of the brethren of the common life, for they were always insisting on the fervent as over against the formal. And with Erasmus, it's the internal as over against the external. And that leads him to criticize many of the practices of the church. Well, then he was back in England again, and in England he had his opportunity finally to go to Italy, which he had long desired. The physician of Henry VII was an Italian, and he wanted to have his 2 boys attend the University of Bologna, and was willing to pay the expenses of Erasmus to supervise their studies. When they arrived in Italy, they received word that the city of Bologna, to which they were going, was being besieged by the armies of the Pope himself, Julius II, Giuliano II, Giuliano il Terribile, the terrible Julius. Pope Julius II was a mighty prince of the Renaissance, a patron of arts and letters. It was he who discovered Raffaele, Michelangelo, Bramante. It was for him that Michelangelo did the Moses, which was to have been a part of his great mausoleum. Magnificent, superb, titanic. He was resolved to recover the estates of the church. Now, throughout the Middle Ages, you know, the church ruled over a strip of Italy running from Rome over the Apennines to Ravenna. Ruled as civil ruler and collected taxes from the whole area. That was one of the sources of income for the papacy. But during a period of disorder in the early 16th century, the Italian cities had been encroaching on the lands of the church. And Bologna had taken a part, and Ferrara a part, and Venice was pressing on it. And Pope Julius was determined that he would recover what was called the patrimony of St. Peter, the patrimonium sancti Petri, the estates of the church. And in armor, at the head of his own troops, he marched on Bologna and captured the city. The news reached Erasmus and the boys that it had fallen. They continued their journey and arrived in time to witness the Pope's triumphal procession. White stallions going ahead, the princes of the state, the princes of the church, the Pope in a palanquin carried aloft by his soldiers to the church, where they praise the Lord Jesus for this glorious victory. I viewed it with a groan, says Erasmus. Magnu cum gemitu. Pope Julius playing Julius Caesar. And when he went out into the countryside, he saw the papal tax collectors taking cows away from the peasants. Then an opportunity came to go for a year to Venice. He'd finished his assignment with the boys, and I don't know where the money came from, but somebody usually helped him out. He spent a whole year in Venice with the great printer Aldus Manutius. Aldus had a household of 33 people, all talking Greek. They were Greeks from Constantinople, most of them, and some were Italians who were there to learn Greek. Erasmus was determined to know Greek not only as a written language, but as a spoken language. During that year, his collection of proverbs was enormously increased and was published by Aldus. We have the edition in the Yale Library, a magnificent production. And so big that when Aldus offered Erasmus several hundred copies, he said, "I'll be glad to accept them if you'll give me also another horse." One other little point about this stay in Venice, which will come up later. Erasmus, during that year, roomed with a young Italian named Aleander, a brilliant man, very skilled in languages, charming. Erasmus was almost as attracted to him as he had been to Thomas More. Later on, we shall meet Aleander as the prosecutor against Luther at the Diet of Worms. After the year in Venice, Erasmus went to Rome. He was gaining a reputation. Cardinals received him with respect and courtesy. And one of them invited him to go and see a bullfight in the papal palace. Julius II had bullfights. There was no Colosseum for the purpose, but they formed a ring of soldiers with pikes like this around, and then the bull was inside and the fight took place. Erasmus describes it. He says, after the animal had been killed and dragged out, they had a comic interlude before the next bullfight. A man came in with the cape over his arm and with his sword. There's no bull, you understand. This is all pantomime. He points his sword at the bull. You can feel the bull charges. The man flings his cape over in the corner. The bull, you can feel, goes over and sniffs it. And then the bull withdraws, and the man very gingerly retrieves his cape. Then he points his sword again. The bull makes another charge. The man jumps into the safety area and gets the bull going round and round and round until he's breathless. And then the man leaps on his back and crows in triumph. I enjoyed that pantomime more than the bloody sport. Now that's Erasmus. He hated violence and cruelty and brutality, whether to man or to beast. While he was in Rome, a letter reached him from his old friend Lord Mountjoy saying, "Come to Italy. The golden age has dawned. Our glorious prince has become Henry VIII. You can't imagine the enthusiasm for Henry VIII when he was first king. A handsome young man, a fine athlete, a scholar. He could write Latin letters. He'd written several to Erasmus in his own hand. He studied theology. Later on, he was able to write against Luther. He was a patron of letters. They all thought that this now was to be the golden age for England. Come to England. The king wants you. He's written himself. Archbishop Warren will give you a living. Come to England." Erasmus started out on horseback. It would take him about 3 weeks. There's some advantages in horseback. Gives you a chance to think. Arriving in London, he stayed in the home of Thomas More, and resting up from his journey, he put on paper a little fantasy which he had conceived on the way. He called it The Praise of More. In Greek, Encomium Moriae. Now, in Greek, the word moria also means foolishness. So it was a pun, the praise of More and the praise of folly. This little skit has been the best known of all the works of Erasmus, though it was only a little jeu d'esprit which he cast off for a bit of amusement. It's a very subtle work. Folly is a dame mounts a rostrum to give a lecture. She begins by saying that she is responsible for the continuation of the human race. For, says she, if people considered how much difficulty is involved in having a baby, they'd never have one. And if they'd had one, they'd never have another. But they don't consider, and I, Folly, carry them along, so I keep the race going. I am responsible, she says, for all great enterprises. If people calculated the cost, they would never have any daring. But they do not calculate, they plunge, and so all great things come to pass. She is spontaneity, recklessness, a lack of calculation. She is also the absence of that brutal candor which vitiates all human relations. Why should you dissipate illusions? If a man thinks that his ugly wife is as beautiful as Penelope, will he not get along better with her than if you disillusion him? A little humbug is the lubricant of life. But then Folly ships her character, and she becomes downright foolishness. She is the folly of a nobleman who wouldn't think of being a butcher but doesn't mind carving up a stag in the chase. She is the folly of a merchant who will leave his family and go to the ends of the earth and risk his life and his fortune to bring home some spices to Portugal. She is the folly of a ruler who is not content with the land that he already has, which he doesn't rule well, but is seeking to increase his territory. She is the folly of a friar who wears a filthy cowl that no ship's captain would put on to shield him in a storm, and thinks that by wearing that thing he can go up to Jesus and claim credit in heaven. It's the folly of a pope who, if he remembered what pope means, papa, father, would never be fighting for the position. Folly is the foolishness of a scholar who ruins his health and his eyes poring over old books like that Erasmus. Well, where are we now? Does he really mean that to be a scholar like himself is as foolish as to be like that nobleman or that prince or that merchant or friar or pope? Or is he just throwing out a sop to calm people down when they've been irritated by his satire? Anyway, this serves as a transition to another meaning of folly, the folly of God, who chooses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty. The foolishness of the cross, a stumbling block to the Jew, and a laughing stock to the Gentile. This is the folly of God. And then once more, she is the folly of the seer, the poet, the mystic, who is wrapped beyond his senses until he is united with the ultimate. It is again the vision of God. What's the meaning of it? Someone has suggested that it's an attempt to reduce everything to rationality, even irrationality. Someone has said that it is the likeness of the spirit of the Renaissance, but it ends with the folly of the cross. I think a clue to it may be found in a sermon of Erasmus later on Vanity of Vanities, and he goes through a whole list, and it's just the ones that he has pilloried in the praise of folly. And then he says, shall we then not have family life, or political life, or scholarship? Nay, in all these we shall participate, but, as if not participating, with an inner detachment, remembering that we are strangers and pilgrims, traveling to a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I think it is an ironic version of the contempt of the world. Back in England, he worked for several years quietly, working hard on Greek, making a new translation of the New Testament, until the year 1511, when he had to leave England because that glorious Prince Henry had gone to war on behalf of Pope Julius. It came about in this way. Julius had taken Bologna and Ferrara, and now he was fighting Venice. The French came in to help Venice against the Pope, and then the English came in to embarrass the French, and by so doing, they were supporting the Pope. So Henry VIII was actually lined up on the side of Pope Julius. And he so taxed all the rich in England, there was no money for them to help Erasmus. And most of his friends had to go over to the continent in connection with the war. So Erasmus went back to the Netherlands and lived there for some years in extreme poverty. Now in the year 1513, Pope Julius died. And then there appeared an anonymous tract, the title of which was Pope Julius Excluded from Heaven. It is a dialogue between Peter and the Pope. And the Pope has a little companion who occasionally throws in a remark. We see Pope Julius coming up to the gate of heaven. He takes his key and puts it in the lock. What the devil? His companion says, maybe you got the wrong key. No, he said it's the key of power. It used to work on earth. Peter hears this and he comes and looks over the gate and he says, what a stench, who are you? The Pope is in armor and has the letters PM on his chest. He says, can't you read? PM. Peter says, pestis maximus, a big pest. Pontifex maximus, and who are you to talk to me? I'm a Ligurian Italian and you're only a Jew. Oh. Well, now, why do you care what country you belong to? I want my country to have the credit of me. Well, what have you done that's so creditable? I captured Bologna. Oh. Was the ruler a tyrant? Was he a heretic? No. Well, what then? I wanted it for my son. Popes with wives and sons? No, you don't understand. Sons, not wives. Well, tell me again, what have you done that I should let you in? I built up the papacy. I've made it glorious. You should see our processions. Boys dancing, horses prancing, bugles blowing, dishes steaming. And I carried aloft on the shoulders of my soldiers. It's magnificent. We didn't have anything like that in my day. Well, the job wasn't worth having in your day. We knew shipwreck, scourgings, imprisonments, executions, crosses, and by suffering, we conquered. Well, you wait then until more of my soldiers die, and next year we'll come up and knock your gates down. Did Erasmus write that? He did not say, I did not write it. He said, how would anyone think I would do such a thing? But we know from the correspondence of Thomas More that there was a manuscript in Erasmus' own hand. Now, of course, that doesn't prove it. He might have copied it. But Thomas More attempted to help him out of his predicament and gave all the reasons why it wasn't likely that he would have written it, and then said, but suppose he did. He knew the circumstances. Would he ever have supposed that he did if he knew that he didn't? Then there's another point. There's a poem which is even more stinging. It makes a comparison between Pope Julius and Julius Caesar and says there's only one thing lacking, and that is another Brutus. Now, there was long debate as to whether Erasmus wrote that. But about a couple of years ago, inside the flyleaf of one of the works of Erasmus, that poem turned up in his own hand. But there is one curious thing. There's an early edition which has on the flyleaf the initials of Faustus Andrelinus, that Italian to whom he wrote that letter from England, that gay blade. And some have thought that probably Faustus Andrelinus may have written it. But everything else that he wrote hardly has this verb and style. But I think it's entirely conceivable that they collaborated, because there's a lot of detail about the dealings of the Pope with France, which Faustus would know better than Erasmus. Erasmus and More collaborated on the Utopia. It's quite possible that Faustus and Erasmus collaborated on this skit. But a greater interest attaches to the form of attack. Is an anonymous satire an effective mode of carrying an idea? It's dangerous because if a man is ever suspected of it, he may have attributed to him a dozen satires that he didn't write. And that happened to Erasmus repeatedly. But it also illustrates a point with regard to the strategy of reform. It may really call for differences in vocation. One man to slug and the other man to say, now let us reason together. The man who was slugged can't go around and ask anybody to reason. But if somebody hasn't struck, there'll be nothing to reason about. Now, Erasmus is doing, not letting his right hand know what his left hand's doing. He smites with one hand, and then he goes around and says, now be reasonable. It's a question whether the same man can combine the two techniques. But he was doing a lot more than engaging in satire. He was working on editions of the Fathers and of the Bible all this time. He wrote a number of political tracts, one for the future Emperor Charles V on principles of government, and then a tract called The Complaint of Peace, Querela Pacis, in which he imagines peace personified as a woman going up and down the earth and everywhere rejected. She goes to a walled city and thinks that being contained, they will be at peace. But inside, she finds a war between the rich and the poor. She goes to the universities and finds that the philosophers and the theologians are quarreling. She goes to a family, and there's more peace here than there is in a monastery. But even so, husband and wife are not always agreed. She turns to an individual, and the reason and the passions are at war. How strange, for in the Old Testament we have a prediction of the coming of a Prince of Peace, and in the New, my peace I give unto you. And who's responsible for all this? Not young men, but old, and not the laity, but the clergy. Princes and kings, who even cast cannons with the names of the apostles. Henry VIII had just done it. 12 cannons, each one bearing the name of one of the apostles, that Peter and Paul may go out to the field of battle and blast each other. Consider the cost of it. With what it costs to besiege a city until it surrenders, you could build another one. Consider the wickedness of it. Men who'd be locked up in time of peace can be let out to be guilty of assassination and arson in time of war. Consider the folly of it. Man is but the creature of a summer's day, and why should he be in such haste to destroy himself? What then? Let us give up these national cries saying that the Englishman is the natural enemy of the Frenchman, or the Frenchman of the German and the Spaniard. Though the channel flows between England and France, it shall not divide those who are united in the love of Christ. The Pyrenees divide France and Spain, and the Rhine, France and Germany, but they cannot divide those who are held in the bond of the gospel. Let us then bind up discord with adamantine chains which never shall be broken. This is not satire. This is direct prophetic blazing against brutality. And we find it in many of the writings of Erasmus. Well, now, he had been in the Netherlands, but he was going back and forth to Basel in Switzerland frequently because of the great printer Froebel in Basel, who in the year 1516 brought out for Erasmus two great works. One, an edition of the letters and other works of the great church father, St. Jerome, with commentaries by Erasmus. The other, much more significant, the New Testament in Greek, in print, for the first time in history. in the year 1516. Now we have a first edition in our library at Yale. From the point of view of scholarship and inadequate work, Erasmus himself said, precipitated rather than edited, because Froben had pushed him and he'd done the whole thing in 6 months. He had only 5 manuscripts to work from, and none of them earlier than the 11th century. Later on, the text was much improved through the discovery of more materials, but it was a pioneer work. It meant now that every serious scholar could have a copy of the Greek text before him. It facilitated collation. It was a dangerous, a risky procedure to bring manuscripts from Spain or Poland or Italy to one place. They might be lost. But if you had 1,000 copies of a book, you could send the book to the manuscript and put all of the variants in the margin and then send the book back. And if you lost it, you could do it with another book. So in this way, you could collect more and more information from the various manuscripts. It aided collation. But the achievement of Erasmus lay not merely in making the text available, but also in making his contemporaries aware of the problems. They had assumed that the Latin translation by St. Jerome was made from an absolutely perfect Greek text, and that Jerome made absolutely no mistakes, and therefore nobody should touch his translation. Had not all the decrees of councils and popes for the last 1,000 years been based on this Latin version? Can you say that this wasn't inspired by the Holy Ghost? Well, said Erasmus, St. Jerome corrected those that went before him, and there's no reason why he shouldn't be corrected. And as a matter of fact, if you get back to the Greek manuscripts and put them together, you will find that they don't agree. You simply got to go back and compare them. Erasmus left out, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory," at the end of the Lord's Prayer in Matthew. He said it's not in the Greek manuscripts. It probably was introduced from the liturgy. It's now agreed that he was right, that it came in from the Syrian liturgy. The Catholics, of course, don't use it. They follow Luke's version that doesn't have it. The Protestants have followed the fuller one in Matthew. And I don't see why we shouldn't pray it. It's a perfectly good prayer. But it's not in the original manuscripts. And then he left out in 1 John 5:7, "There are 3 in heaven that witness, the Father, the Logos, and the Holy Spirit." That was the great Trinitarian verse. Erasmus left it out. He said it's not in the manuscripts. They said, "You don't believe in the Trinity." I didn't say I don't believe in the Trinity. I'm simply telling you it's not there, that's all. And if you can find it in a single Greek manuscript, I'll put it in the next edition. Well, they found one. He suspected it was manufactured for the purpose, and we know that it was. But true to his word, he put it back in. Did he merely yield to pressure? Not exactly. He said, it's not only not in the manuscripts that I have, but it was not in the Greek father, St. Cyril. It was not in the Latin Father Bede in the early centuries. They didn't know it. But it is in the Latin translation made by Jerome in the 4th century. Now, Jerome certainly wouldn't have made it up. He must have had it in the Greek text that he used. Therefore, there must have been a discrepancy in the manuscripts as early as that. In that case, who am I to decide? What Erasmus did not know was that he doesn't get into the Latin translation of St. Jerome till the 8th century. Somebody put it into Jerome later on. If you want to use a translation to check an original, you've got to have the correct text of the translation. Now that he didn't know, so he put it back. He did that in 1522. Now Luther worked from the New Testament of Erasmus of 1519 that doesn't have it, so he did not go into the German. But Tyndall and the English worked from the edition of 1522, and it went into the King James. But it's been taken out in the Revised Standard Version. Pope Leo XIII said it was genuine, but more recently a committee of Catholic scholars has ruled that it is spurious. So now there's complete agreement between Catholics and Protestants that that does not belong in the text. So there were the questions of the text, then the matter of translation. Erasmus said, you've got to realize that the Greek of the New Testament was not the Greek of Demosthenes. One of his opponents said, do you mean to say that the apostles didn't write perfect Greek when they were given the gift of tongues by the Holy Ghost? Well, said Erasmus, if you look over the list of languages of which the apostles were given command at Pentecost by the Holy Ghost, you'll find the Greek isn't one of them. You've got to learn the Greek of the New Testament, and it's not the Greek, it's not classical Greek. Then comes the matter of translation. The Vulgate said, and Christ came saying, do penance, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Erasmus translated it, be penitent, and later on simply repent. And that's what we have. Jesus came saying, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. But do penance was the standard text in favor of the sacrament of penance. Luther immediately picked that up in Erasmus' translation and made very good use of it in his initial controversy with the church. Perhaps I haven't made clear that Erasmus, when he brought out the New Testament in Greek, in a parallel column on the same page, had a new Latin translation. Not that, the standard one of St. Jerome. These two lie side by side. So Luther had both of those in front of him when he did his translation. And he picks that up at once. Then came another translation in John's Gospel in the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. Now, in the Vulgate, that is translated in principio erat verbum, V-E-R-B-U-M. Our English word verbosity is, and verbal, and all those are derived from it. Verbum, meaning word. But Erasmus translated it sermo, S-E-R-M-O. Our word sermon comes from it. They said, you don't believe in the incarnation of the Son of God as the Word. I said nothing of the kind. I'm simply telling you that the Greek word logos, that's the word in the Greek, is better translated by sermo than by verbum, because verbum means a grammatical form of speech, a word, this word, that word, and the other word. But sermo means connected, meaningful discourse. We might even translate it, he said, eloquence, the eloquence of God, by which God communicates. This is the unique title of Christ. Men are sometimes called sons of gods and even gods. They're never called the Word of God, the eloquence of God. Christ was the sermo, the meaningful discourse of God. We preach the sermons. Then, in addition to the Greek text and the translation, Erasmus wrote annotations, which often grew into essays, and paraphrases. He paraphrased the whole of the New Testament in Latin, but his paraphrases were translated into the vernaculars. In fact, his paraphrases on the Gospels were translated into English, and under Edward VI, there was a requirement that a copy be set up alongside of the Bible in every parish church in England. We have two copies of the original in our Yale library. These paraphrases take the Gospel story and elaborate in simple language, but in such fashion that in a measure they become commentaries. And I'll give you just one example. Take his treatment of the prodigal son. And when he came to himself, he arose. And he said, I will go to my father. And I will say, Father, I have sinned before heaven and before thee, and I am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thine hired servants. And he arose. And while he was yet a long way off, his father saw him and ran. He who had the greater love did first espy the other. The old man ran. And the boy began his speech. Father, I have sinned. But he wasn't allowed to finish it. The father threw his arms about his neck and kissed him and called for the ring and the robe and the fatted calf. Now, that father is God. This is Erasmus, a scholar, a pamphleteer, a satirist, a commentator on the scriptures. It was the year 1516. He was 50, if he was born in the right year to make him 50, and I think he was. He was at the pinnacle of his reputation. No man had so many friends in high circles all over Europe as Erasmus of Rotterdam. Kings were inviting him to their courts, Francis I in his own hand, they had the letter in Basel. Henry VIII, the Emperor Charles, made him one of his counselors. Cardinal Ximenes, the Primate of Spain, invited him to Spain. Several popes invited him to Rome. Ferdinand of Austria wanted him in Vienna. Bishops, town councilors, magnates, universities, all would be proud to have Erasmus working in their midst. And the new Pope, Leo X, gave a very commendatory letter to his New Testament, which was printed at the head of every succeeding edition. No man was looked upon with greater esteem than Erasmus. And the next year, Luther posted his theses on the door of the Castle Church at Wittenberg, and thereby started a train of events which made Erasmus in the end almost the outlaw of Europe. Now next time I'll deal with Luther through the Diet of Worms.